Welcome to Ascend Radio, where we talk about some of the biggest news and issues in regulation and digital government, as well as the people with deep experience in those fields. And today I'm excited to speak with Bailey Crotty of Oklahoma's Real Estate Commission, or OREC, as they call it. Bailey Crotty is deputy director at OREC, and there she oversaw the agency's huge project to modernize and automate OREC's manual and antiquated processes for issuing and renewing licenses. In our conversation, Bailey discusses a variety of issues in real estate licensing and the promises and challenges of digital transformation for a government agency like hers. Let's take a listen.
I work for the Oklahoma Real Estate Commission. We license and regulate all real estate professionals in Oklahoma. I have been with the agency for the past 2 years. Prior to working for the government, I have worked for private industry in oil and gas, and then have also done some nonprofit work as well.
How did you wind up at the Real Estate Commission in particular? What was your career path like?
Yeah, so I made the change from going to from private to nonprofit, and I got the full on experience of nonprofit and kind of underestimated how much work-life balance would be afforded to me in that process. And I got a little burnt out, you know. After about 6 months, my partner, he works for a state agency as well, and I saw how much work-life balance he had and the disparity between the two of us. And so I said, you know what, I want to go into government now. And there was a business management position open at the Real Estate Commission, and my background is in accounting, so I thought that was pretty applicable. And luckily enough, here I am, and talking to you today, so thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, no problem. What was your understanding of, you know, regulation and licensing and the world of real estate when you were coming into it?
Yeah, I pretty much knew absolutely nothing. I mean, I've gone through a home purchase before as a consumer. My mom had been a real estate agent for a brief amount of time, but I truly had no background in how state agencies are run or how really real estate is performed by our licensees. And so I just kind of got thrown in the thick of it, to say the least.
I know that, for all the regulators I've talked to, you know, they're very adamant that all of these areas, all these fields are very different, very unique in their own ways. What are some of the ways in which real estate licensing in particular differs from other areas of licensing?
Yeah, absolutely. They are definitely all pretty unique. Something that's unique about real estate, especially in Oklahoma, is that an associate has to be working at a specific firm, and the regulator must know who that firm, you know, who is employing that associate. And so at all times, you know, an associate, if they're actively practicing, needs to be at, you know, big brokerage X. And so keeping track of that and the flexibility of moving from firm to firm, translating that into the tech and into regulating them can be pretty difficult. Real estate agents have a tendency to, you know, move based on maybe their brokerage dues or inadequacies of marketing and things like that. And so they can move fairly quickly, and the regulator has to keep up with that. I think another huge area that is unlike any other licensing agency is that real estate agents do have access, private access to homes. And so when it comes to regulating them, it's extremely important that there's been proper criminal history checks, and making sure that they know how to be in compliance at all times, just because they do have private access to the public's homes and things like that, that maybe another licensing agency like an accountant or something might not.
Right, Right. And in what ways would you say that it's similar to other areas of regulation?
Yeah, it's very similar to other regulators in that we have our standard prerequisites, right? We have education requirements that they must meet. We have an examination that must be passed in all circumstances, and they are required to have a criminal history check. And in state by state, that might vary on what's accepted in a criminal check and what's not, but that is something that's not unique to other licensing. So.
Well, speaking of state-to-state variance, is there anything about Oklahoma in particular and the world of real estate licensing within Oklahoma that you've seen differ from other states?
We recently just got finished with a conference in Florida for regulators across the nation. And I think we all have different state views on what type of qualification someone needs for like moral turpitude and things like that to qualify for a real estate license. I'll give you an example. In I believe it's North Dakota, they do credit checks for part of their prerequisites. And we, used to do things like that, but we have since gotten rid of that. We don't check credit checks, and we don't do any custodial payments, maybe from one parent to another to check to see if you've had child support payments. Those are not things that Oklahoma necessarily looks at. We have a definitive list of crimes that are related to real estate, and those vary, right? It's a long list. It could be something violent or something like embezzlement. And so we try to confine that down so that maybe a DUI misdemeanor might not prevent you from getting a license, but tax fraud would. So it varies state to state, though.
One thing I want to talk today about is this idea of non-resident licenses. When I was new to the field, or rather, I mean, how would you explain it to someone who's coming into it fresh? When I hear non-resident licenses, I think, well, don't you have to be part of, the jurisdiction that you're working within? Isn't that why we have these individual state regulators in every state? What do we mean by non-resident licensing?
Yeah, so in Oklahoma, a non-resident license means that I might house my brick and mortar office in Arkansas or Texas or really anywhere in the United States, but I have associates present and working for me in doing deals in Oklahoma. And so what that means is that someone from California can now enter Oklahoma market share. And it's not necessarily a problem, but it is something that our Oklahoman brokerages face, and that now they have to share that market space, right, with someone that might have a huge brokerage out in California. For the regulator, it can create issues in that, a California brokerage doesn't have as many ties to the community as Oklahoma. And even though we might, we require the same examination, we require the same coursework be done, we require the same criminal background check, they just have to simply pass a minimum standard test, and they might not be as familiar or frankly care as much about Oklahoma state regulation because they're not as easily accessed to do office inspections or audits. There's a lack of accountability, and that's really difficult for some regulators to implement. And Oklahoma is no different than that.
Where do we see, the rubber hit the road when it becomes a problem like that? Like I get conceptually, it can present these issues, but how have we seen those challenges sort of manifest in real ways?
Yeah, so Oklahoma is a complaint-based state. So we on our website have instant access for someone to go online and say, hey, this real estate agent or broker did XYZ in this transaction and I was harmed in the means of that. And so for non-residents, what that means is that sometimes we receive complaints from Oklahoma citizens regarding a brokerage that they're working with in picking on California, but California. And so now the commission has a duty to the licensee and that non-resident, same broker, to properly serve them notice that they've had a complaint against them. And so what becomes difficult is serving them. You know, if you got to have a process server at your door and they're trying to find that address, if the commission hasn't properly obtained that address or the licensee hasn't updated that, it's really easy for someone out of state to really evade being served. And it really puts a stop to the investigations process. If we can't get a thorough response in our investigations process from the licensee that has the complaint against them, we really only have one side of evidence, one testimony, instead of having a full picture of what's happened. Also, when, let's just say, a non-resident broker doesn't participate in the investigations process and we do levy a fine against them, we now have to, at the state level, pursue collections if we are able to, which is difficult, right? If I call you and you're a huge broker and you just had one deal or a couple of deals in Oklahoma, and I'm saying you owe us $10,000 for, you know, violations, now I have no, I'm just not going to participate in having a license anymore. And I might start performing unlicensed activities or just stop working in that state entirely because it's really easy for me to do that.
Is it something that, far as you know, varies state to state? If I have my brokerage in California and I start playing around in Oklahoma, is there anything stopping me from doing that in other states?
Right. So there is some safeguards for state agencies to utilize to prevent licensing. A lot of states require license histories from any state that that person has admitted to previously working in. So if I'm applying to New York and I say I've held a license in Oklahoma, I then have to submit a license history to New York, and most states require that. And on that license history, it'll typically say if I have any violations. But if I have pending violations in a certain state, and I can just simply omit that information if I wanted to, so there is kind of a loophole in that. We also do have the Regulators Association, which is ARELO, they provide resources for state agencies in the real estate world to be able to share information. They do have a disciplinary database that we can, you know, say, okay, this is a non-resident applying from XYZ state, and I can look up their name and see if they have any other violations as well. So there are a couple of things that we can do and that states have in their own right to look up.
Are there any benefits, you know, far as you see it, to enabling non-resident license?
Yeah, there's a lot of benefits to it as well. It allows that licensee to have license portability. I think especially with the technology in place, a lot of us can work from wherever we want, right? I can be logged into my laptop and have been living in Oklahoma for the last 10 years and then up and decide, hey, I want to go be around my parents in Wisconsin, or I want to go out and see the West Coast and live in Washington. And so that license portability is great for our associates to have. I'll also say in some states, it just creates new, you know, market share, right? If you have a brokerage that all of a sudden wants to employ a licensee for our purposes in Arkansas right next door, now that's a whole new market share. There's all these new clients that you have never engaged with before. And in some states, it's pivotal. For example, Kansas and Missouri, you have Kansas City that literally lies on the line between Kansas and Missouri. And so, you know, those realtors have to obtain license in both states and now can practice on both sides of the Mississippi River. And so that's integral to them, you know, being a top producer in their states.
You mentioned unlicensed activity earlier. So I guess, how does unlicensed activity actually happen? I mean, am I going too far in saying that it's illegal?
Right, yes, it is in our state a violation to perform real estate transactions for anyone other than yourself or a business you own or your employer. So I'm not licensed. I am not allowed to go out and sell your home that's in Oklahoma because I don't hold a license. Unlicensed activity in my mind happens in two circumstances. In one circumstance, a current licensee inadvertently allows their license to lapse. And just kind of from absent-mindedness, or especially during the pandemic, we're all thinking about bigger picture items than maybe something like a license. And so they allow their license to lapse, and now they're still performing real estate transactions through listing services or through title companies, and no one's stopping them in that process and saying, hey, your license has lapsed. The other type of unlicensed activity that occurs is through a new person coming into the market share and not even obtaining a license. So for instance, in Oklahoma, we have jurisdiction over property managers. Property management, if you're doing it as a third party, you must hold a brokerage license or an associate license under a brokerage. And we've had numerous cases where someone just starts acting as a third party property manager without a license. And sometimes, you know, I do think inherently people want to comply. They want to do a good job. They mean well. And sometimes it's just, you know, maybe they're uneducated that they need a license. But I'm sure there are also a few bad eggs out there that don't want to pay the government to hold a license and don't want to be, you know, accountable to them to perform education requirements and exam requirements. So those are really the two types of unlicensed activity that take place.
Is there a bit of an onus on the responsible home buyer to when they're dealing with someone or a brokerage or an organization to say, hey, can I see your license?
Right. I think that especially with us moving to more of a remote self-service model, I do think that, you know, you hear about somebody that you know is a real estate agent and you just kind of trust them, right? You're trying to move in a fast-paced environment. You've looked up a house on, you know, a huge listing service online that we all have access to. And you're like, I want it right now. You click, you know, give me a referral, and they shoot someone to you. And so I think that the home buyer sometimes is not saying, hey, produce a license certificate. We supply that to all of our licensees, and we do have a licensee lookup. But I think sometimes the confidence of that person leading the transaction, you know, the buyer might feel comfortable and think, obviously, they've gone through all the credentialing that they need to.
What are the consequences of unlicensed activity? I mean, I presume, you know, if I were doing it, you couldn't take away my license because I didn't have one in the first place. But how might that impact me down the line in the future?
Right. So for the first example where there's a current licensee that has inadvertently allowed their license to lapse, in that example, you know, obviously we hold them accountable and impose a reinstatement fee. If they have been unlicensed and allow their license to lapse for an extended period of time, we have the authority to collect all commissions received during that time. You know, I can speak to in the last year, we've really honed in on unlicensed activity. And, you know, we've had people have commissions in the hundreds of thousands. Now, the commission typically does not, you know, we want people to become licensed. If they're not, or to maintain their license if they had one. So we try to weigh that and not impose that entire fine against them. But it is a huge amount, you know. Most people in today's world are, even if they obtain that commission, it's not like they're putting it in their savings account. They're using it to be able to live. So it's a huge amount to be able to pay back to the commission. And there's also a consequence in that for the current licensee that's had their license lapse, if that listing service or the title company check their license before the closing date, it could impact their ability to close on that house or that commercial property. In the other instance, with the person that had never had a license, the commission again can collect the entire commission if it so felt the need to. And we also have the ability to impose collections through the, you know, county office, et cetera. So that would show up on your credit report and things like that if we truly went after you for those collections. And typically we're trying to engage that unlicensed person to get them licensed and talk to them about how easy the process is and the education that's required. The other consequence is that the unlicensed person, if that home buyer hasn't checked if they have, if that person has a license, they could be have a felon that has a violent criminal history on their record, and now they're in their home trying to sell their home, have private access, etc. So that's why we're here as the regulator, to make sure that those people don't have access to homes. But it really poses a risk to the public if they're not licensed.
I think you've touched on it a bit, but and this is sort of a double-barreled question, but how do you find out about unlicensed activity going on? And B, is there any way in which you monitor and track that sort of thing on an ongoing basis?
Yeah, so we typically find out from, you know, if the unlicensed person is representing one side of the transaction, typically other real estate associates on the other side, the buyer seller side, are aware of the requirement. And so a lot of times they're the ones checking at the time of closing, or, you know, who am I working with and what brokerage are they with? And a lot of times that it's the other licensees complaining. And a lot of the times the consumer, the member of the public themselves, maybe because of a lack of education by the unlicensed person, they are financially harmed in the transaction or misled, and so they prompt a complaint. And we keep notes, and we keep different records so that our licensing staff knows that this person was unlicensed. So when they come through, if they have outstanding fines due or things like that, that we know to collect that before we'll even issue them a license. We also do report that unlicensed activity to Arello, that disciplinary database that I referenced, because a lot of times if it's a bad egg and someone that is intentionally not obtaining a license, they're probably doing it in other states as well.
Right. And to that point, and maybe, you know, being involved with Arello gives you some insight, but as far as you know, state to state, are there places where it's more problematic, less problematic? Are there hotspots of unlicensed activity as far as you know?
I think that for the most part, it is just a matter of it being in every state. I do think that as the economic trends change, and maybe, you know, places like Nashville or Indianapolis, other places where there's a huge real estate boom, and development being made, I think that naturally people are drawn to those places. We have seen that, you know, I think everyone is experiencing the real estate boom right now, even during the pandemic, from the lack of housing inventory. But as those real estate markets go up, you have people interested in making money off of that. So you have people that, you know, are now marketing in those states and those cities that people are trying to buy in. So I think that's really where the unlicensed activity happens more frequently. I do think it happens in every state, and it's fairly consistent overall, especially with current licensees lapsing. We all experience that. But there's different things you can do to prevent it, you know. For us, the technology that we've implemented from our licensing system has really allowed for our staff to be alleviated from tasks that, you know, administrative tasks that were just this repetitive and that took a lot of time to manually process. Now, because we have automated systems in place and we have that technology, we have time to call all of our licensees that are up for renewal. And we have reporting and metrics to show us this is the list of, you know, 20% of the licensees in this given month that haven't renewed yet. Okay, let's call those people. One of the differences, too, that I forgot to highlight is real estate agents tend to change their email frequently. If I'm working for Avenger Brokerage and then I transfer to X-Men Brokerage, I might have had my domain as my email at AvengerBrokerage.com, and when I transferred, I have now lost my email access. And I had that registered with a commission for my renewal reminders. But some of the technology that we're working on with Ventia is to provide SMS text notifications. One thing that realtors don't change is their phone number, because that's how their clients call them, even regardless of which company they're working or have worked for. And so getting that engagement decreases the unlicensed activity, because most people don't want to let their license lapse.
We've touched on the pandemic a few times, and I want to get a little bit more into that. If I'm correct, you joined in September 2020, is that correct?
That's correct. So Grant, my executive director, and I really came into our roles in late February 2020, right before the pandemic hit. And it was a very quick and unfortunately reactive process because of how much the pandemic affected our agency.
How did you initially adapt to that situation? Were there any, from your previous experience, perhaps, were there any best practices or, first principles that you applied to figuring out how you were going to navigate this world?
Right. So when we first started in the pandemic, our agency was already had pretty low performance when it came to customer service. We were already, before the pandemic, taking 2 weeks to look at an application and get it into the system if it was sent to us complete through snail mail. We were taking a week to process, a quick transfer from firm brokerage to brokerage. So we were already not performing well. And one thing that I think was our saving grace is that we started looking to our peers to see, what are you doing that's working well? And we started looking to peers that had already, transformed digitally. Kind of didn't have a bump in the road from the pandemic. And, I think for part of our time, we were just trying to tread water and get processes in place to make sure we could maintain even our lower standards of customer service. But one of the things that Grant had a great idea of was, hey, can you call some real estate commissions and talk to them about their licensing system? And when someone gives me a task, I try to do it tenfold. So I called every real estate commission and had an Excel spreadsheet with columns and notes on what system they had, if they recommended it, if it was going well, how much the cost was. to see if that was something that was obtainable. And what I found was the states that had in-house state IT built systems, just like ours, were unable to adapt very quickly. You know, I think that sometimes the state has to move slow because of bureaucracy and just having the manpower to throw work at a project. And so a lot of the state agencies I spoke with that had an in-house built system like we did were really suffering just as much as we were to perform basic licensing procedures. So
you literally called every real estate regulator across the US?
Yeah, anybody that would answer me. I think one of the things that the pandemic taught us, right, is about phone calls and how we handle them, which I think on a given day no one really thinks about, but a lot of the states when we were calling them had implemented a messaging system, and we in turn tried to do that. We did the same thing. We turned from having live phone calls come in, we started having any voicemails left to our help desk started becoming attachments. And that way we could route them to someone if they had to work from home because they weren't feeling good, or we could route them to the right person because now we could listen to a voicemail instead of getting a live call. But when I was calling all of these real estate commissions, you know, we learned just from doing that that they all had different messages related to COVID-19, and they all had different turnaround times for my phone call, even if they called me back or not. I think I got phone calls back from about 50% of the 49 states I called. But sometimes those phone calls took weeks to get back. And granted, my question wasn't an urgent licensing issue, but we learned from just doing those phone calls as well that we could change our voicemail setup and reprocess our phone calls.
Did you take away any other insights from all of those conversations you were having with your peers across the U.S.?
I think I underestimated the pure cost of and time commitment to being able to implement a new licensing system. I was on the phone with people that weren't using an in-state design system. They were using, you know, a big player in the licensing software world. And sometimes I got phone calls that the regulator was stuck in implementation for a year, 2 years, and paying hundreds of thousands of dollars. And something that really helped us kind of narrow down the field of what vendor we would choose was pure implementation costs. Our agency only had 3 months cash reserve at the time of COVID-19, and the previous management had been not acting in a conservative manner when it came to spending. And so when Grant and I took over, that was one of the first things we had to address was our finances and how we were going to make sure that we were fiscally responsible. And we didn't even have an option to pay hundreds of thousands of dollars for an implementation cost. We also had a very tight and narrow deadline that our in-house, in-state provider was going to be ending December 31st, 2020. And so we didn't really have the option for it to take 2 years. And to be frank, our licensees, they really, you know, were put in a position that they could only receive digital services because of the pandemic. And so putting our backs in the corner, it made that decision very easy for us throughout that time.
I think any organization that has gone through the process of dealing with the pandemic has come out of it changed. That's inevitable. And in the world of regulation and licensing, I'm wondering, in the ways that you've changed at the Oklahoma Real Estate Commission, Which of those elements do you see being permanent changes moving forward, and which of those do you see as we're going to go back to normal? And you know, one that comes to mind, because I've been talking to other regulators about it, is something like remote examinations, which were basically kind of forced when a few months after the pandemic set in, and for some will continue to be part of the process, and for others will not be.
I always view technology as kind of this freight train, and you're either on it or you're off it, and it is not slowing down for anyone. And I do think that technology pushes everything forward. It really, in our instance, with the lack of it really shows your weaknesses. But when you can implement great technology, it can really accelerate your performance, whether you're in the private industry or a regulator. I think some of the factors that we're never going back to is this idea of having to, like you said, take a s examination in person. I think it poses, in the midst of a pandemic, a health risk to those that are a vulnerable population. I also think that it's 2021, and if I can go through my university and take examinations through my university at my home computer and show the proctor, I don't have any resources available to me, I am not cheating, why can't I do that for an educator? I also think the idea of self-service in the wake of the pandemic is not going to go away. I think at first, people were upset, right, that all regulators across the nation were moving to more of a self-service platform. But it's pretty empowering to be able to log in and have your license digitally on your phone and take a screenshot, and there it is. It's pretty empowering to be able to say, hey, I just got married, here's my name change request, and I just had to upload it, and you do it everything on my phone. So I don't think that the concept of self-service is going away. I don't think that virtual meetings are going away. I think people really want person-to-person engagement, and that's why they seek out in, live services. But platforms like any video streaming services like Zoom, GoToMeeting, etc., really take that away when you can implement great sound, audio, and visual. And I can safely meet with somebody that might be a health risk for COVID-19, and they're not sick, but it's dangerous for them to come in. And now I can still meet with them and still talk about whatever item we need to, and they can still feel like they're seeing my responses. And maybe it's not in person, but it's the next best thing. I also think that work from home culture is not going away. I think that, and not now, soon it's going to be something that employees, whether it's a state regulator or private, start to seek out as part of a benefit of joining a company or a regulator, is having some, whether it's flexible work from home or partial work from home. I think that people, I'm an introvert, and some of us enjoy working from home. And I think that dynamic of having that flexibility isn't going away.
You've recently gone through at the Real Estate Commission a digital transformation, a digital modernization, whichever you care to call it. And you know, I see from looking, you know, state to state, province to province in Canada, there is a huge variance across regulators in terms of their maturity in adopting. The